and welcome to this fortnight's episode of House of Comments. My name is Emma Burnell, and I'm a political journalist, largely writing from the left. And I am joined, as always, by Mark Thompson, everyone's favourite centrist dad. Hello, Mark.
Hello. I write from the left as well. I start on the left, and then I move to the right-hand side of the page. So I don't know if that counts.
Well, I did say that that was your political journey. And we're delighted today. We don't have our usual Nick Dennis with us, but we have a much, much better, in my opinion, replacement, who has halved our demographic instantly. So I'm very delighted to welcome Chloe Shendall-Wilson, who is a Conservative member and activist. Hello, Chloe.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I thought we'd just leap straight into it with the mess over the collapse of Carillion. Carillion are one of the big outsourcing companies who have a number of public sector contracts in a huge, huge variety of areas, including local government and central government. I believe they also have a lot of work in schools. I've seen pictures of firemen doling out lunches, things like that. So there is obviously an enormous gap that's been left behind by the sudden collapse of this company. There are something like 42,000 jobs that they directly employed, plus, of course, a number of subcontractors who are all very nervously awaiting details of what's going to come next. So, Mark, what's your take on this story? What do you think are the key lessons that need to be learned?
I mean, I think a very important lesson, which I think we as a country really need to learn, certainly the government needs to learn, is that outsourcing stuff to massive private companies is not a panacea. There seems to have been a kind of dogma that has been reached over the last 20, 30 years. The Tories obviously were great proponents of it in the 80s and the 90s when they were in government, but New Labour took up the mantle and, you know, carried on with it. You know, Blair was a great evangelist for this sort of thing as well, as was Gordon Brown in the Treasury, which is the idea that the public sector can't really do all the things that we would want it to do, and therefore we're going to outsource it to the private sector. And the idea is that the private sector is more efficient, they will bid against each other, and you will get better value for money. You know, that's where this whole kind of PFI thing has come from, which, you know, future generations are going to be saddled with the debt for, a private finance initiative, for anyone who's not familiar with that acronym. I suspect all our listeners are, though. And I just think that we need to learn the lessons that actually that approach doesn't work in quite a lot of cases. You know, this is not the first time that we've seen this sort of problem. You know, we've seen problems with G4. What happened with the Olympics, when at the very last minute the public sector had to step in, and yet G4S is still given contracts by the government. We've got this situation with Carillion here, and you know, effectively what you're having is a situation where the risk is being borne by the taxpayer. So you're privatizing the profits and you're socializing the risk. And I don't think that's acceptable, because at the end of the day, these people who are running these big companies, they're still getting, I think the CEO of Carillion is still going to get paid till October, £660,000. It's like, hang on a minute, where's the incentive for these big corporate bosses? Okay, he'll ultimately lose his job probably. There'll probably be some other job for him in another private sector company in a couple of years' time when the dust settles. That's the way this thing works.
I believe you've already got another job running a public sector company. Well,
that's what I'm talking about. Now, I don't want to come across as some kind of, you know, lefty, you know, communist. That's not what where I'm coming from. I don't think you have to be on the left or a diehard, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Labour member to think that there's something wrong here and something that we really need to think structurally about. You know, why are we in a situation where these private companies can make millions and millions of pounds out of these contracts, and yet when it all goes wrong, the public sector has to step in and rescue the situation, and the public sector is going to have to step in and do something about all the people who lose their jobs, and they're going to have to do something about the pension liabilities. It really feels like something has to change.
Chloe, I hate to throw you straight into the deep end,
but
obviously this is Is this a failing of capitalism or is this a failing of bad capitalism?
It's not a positive of capitalism, they say that. And I can actually mark a lot of what you were saying, I do completely agree with. But I read a couple of things this morning, and one was saying, like, is this a failure of capitalism? Or is it, you know, cronyism? Like what you were saying, you know, did George Osborne make a mistake in sort of who he gave it to? And should we be opening up the market, you know, for smaller businesses to be able to run these things or for more reliable businesses? You know, capitalism doesn't really work if so many people are dominating the market. And, you know, should we open up space for other people to compete? But I read a really good article this morning by Kate Andrews of the IEA, which obviously is a real, like, free market libertarian think tank. But she made the point of that something's gone wrong here, but saying that the state should run all of these things isn't necessarily the answer. Because on one hand, we're saying, particularly kind of like on the left-wing commentators, saying we can't trust the government, they've made a mistake with this, they've messed up. But on the other hand, is then handing over all of this power for the government to run it, is that necessarily the answer? And are there more kind of alternative solutions? Which I thought was a really good point, actually. You know, on the one hand, we can't say the government's can't be trusted. On the other hand, think they should run everything. And also, she said maybe the taxpayers shouldn't be picking this up, because if this company's failed, and if, like you said, if this chief exec has done a terrible job of running this, maybe they should get their comeuppance. Maybe taxpayers shouldn't be picking up the bill. That's just how these things work.
I mean, I think there are a couple of problems with that. Firstly, I'd say that it's not the government that failed. It's the private sector that failed, ultimately. The private sector screwed this up. They made promises they couldn't keep and a contract they couldn't stick to. Now, the government should not have signed off that contract. We should take the pressure off the government to always sign with the lowest bidder rather than the best bidder. We need much, much better people who are much better at every level of government. And I've actually written about this in my old job. Procurement is a skill that is needed in local government, in central government. You know, too many people don't understand what they're doing when they're putting together bids and tender processes. So they can be taken advantage of by the more rapacious end of the capitalist system. That being said, it is not the government that messed this up. It was Carillion who couldn't deliver. And so I think the answer to has the private sector has screwed us over, let's get more private sector, which is where Kate Anders is coming from, is a reach for me. The other question, and again, in an ideal world, of course the government and the taxpayer wouldn't pick up the bill for this. But the problem is there are children who will go unfed. There are people whose jobs will go unpaid. There are people whose lives depend on these public services. And the government has to be the last backstop of that. I don't know where the money comes from to do that if it isn't the government picking up, given that it turns out Carillion has no money. That's why they've gone under. There may be better insurance models or what have you for, and it may be that one of the things that needs to happen if we maintain this model of having large outsourcing is that it needs to have some sort of backup insurance system, which they all have to pay into, so that when these things happen, it's not the taxpayer who picks up the bill. So that might be a way of looking at that from a private sector perspective. I think I am not wedded to 100% public sector ownership or delivery of services. I buy the what matters is what works narrative. But what the problem is at the moment, these public-private sector partnerships are not working. And as long as that's the case, then ultimately, if it is always going to be the government who has to be backstop, then I'd rather see them investing money into better delivery. And if that means internal, then so be it. That, I think, is how you have to. The final point that I think is interesting on this is a lot of the, and Mark, you brought this up yourself, a lot of the critique from the right or the response to the left's critique has been, yes, but you did it too, Blair did it. And I think part of the problem with that narrative is that it just doesn't work as a political narrative against Jeremy Corbyn, because Jeremy Corbyn's answer to that is, yeah, and am I Blair? You know, the whole point of Jeremy Corbyn within Labour and within the country is to be the anti-Blair. So I don't think that works well as a political attack on the current Labour Party, even if there are people within the Labour benches who would have voted this through, who would have supported it.
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because I'm not, even though obviously I'm a Conservative, I'm not of the impression either that everything has to be private. Again, what works and what practically works is what's best. But I'm also not for the argument that if something doesn't work, that's it, we have to nationalise it. That's the only reason. I just don't buy it. But I think a lot of, and we were talking earlier, weren't we, about my generation in terms of, I guess, social democracy, looking at Scandinavian countries. The Scandinavian countries seem to be able to do this well. I mean, we get so up in arms when we talk about any element of the public sector here being privatised, and we kind of really demonise it. The narrative, the language that's used is really like, this is so appalling. But a lot of the European countries seem to manage to do this okay. You know, they seem to have gotten this right, allowing the private sector to manage their services while the people still feel like they're not being done a disservice, and there's an element of fairness here. I'm not a socialist. I don't think socialism's the answer, but I think capitalism is. But we need to look really at how the Europeans do this, because they seem to be able to do it fine. That, you know, their private sector's managed so much of their public services, and they don't seem to have the element that we have here of feeling like it's really unfair, or feeling like it's just people at the top that are winning out of it.
I think that's really interesting. I think part of the reason for that, I would say, is that what they also have in those countries is much more state intervention in things like wage policy, much higher taxes. So it's a trade-off, really. Mm. And I think the problem we have here, certainly here within the right, the narrative on the right, is that they wouldn't be willing to accept that trade-off. They just want the one half of it where you have lots of private sector involvement, but they want absolutely no quid pro quo of government involvement in the private sector.
Mm. We seem to have, I had a conversation with someone about this on the coach the other week. They brought it up, not me. It was a stranger.
Do you just travel the country having conversations about politics
all day? And they said to me, and this, they were from Sweden, and they said, in this country, the thing that we've got is we don't have a kind of contract in terms of the relationship between the British people and the British government. Mm. It doesn't seem to be defined at the moment. And we seem to have on one end of the scale thinking that, you know, the government should just do whatever they like and businesses can do whatever they like and people are just supposed to take it. On the other end of the scale, thinking the government should have ultimate control. And we seem to just flop in between both of those, depending on what party we decide to elect at that time. And I think maybe that needs a real look at. I don't think people in this country feel like they have, the relationship isn't really defined at the moment.
So we're swinging from one end of the pendulum to the other.
Mm.
So what you want is the middle pendulum view. Mark, that's your cue.
I'm not going to pretend I know what the answer to this problem is. I mean, I suspect it probably is right to have some private sector involvement. And indeed, there are times when it does work very well. But I think part of the problem, I think you alluded to it, Chloe, is that it always seems to be these massive corporate behemoths that get these contracts. And, you know, I've worked in the private sector all of my career. And I have to say, I mean, I said this on Twitter today, you know, some of the large organisations that I've either worked for or with are as sclerotic and bureaucratic and dysfunctional as anything in the public sector, as far as I can see. You know, just because something's private doesn't mean it's going to be run well. You know, there's plenty of levels of bureaucracy and not being able to get things signed off unless you go through seven layers of management in private companies. There are in the public sector. It just, as I said at the start, it is not a panacea. It never has been. And I think we need to get away from this idea. There are some people who literally think, you know, private good, public bad. You know, it must be the private sector. The private sector, by definition, will be better. And that simply is not always the case.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've worked in both sectors. And yeah, human nature is human nature. We set up systems that mirror the best and worst of human nature, whether that's public or private, frankly. I worked in terrible bureaucracies in the private sector. I've worked in quite innovative spaces in the public and voluntary sector, and vice versa. So, you know, I think it just mirrors who you're working with and who you're working for, frankly.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I mean, I don't think we've got any answers on the Carillion thing. I mean, who is to blame for Carillion? Is it George Osborne? Are you, interestingly, Chloe, is you the one who brought that up first?
I don't know who's to blame. I just think it's something something to learn from, which is why I don't mind the argument of, you know, that maybe they need to learn their lesson. You know, maybe the taxpayer shouldn't bail them out because maybe this is just how these things work.
I think it's
insidious to try and blame one individual person. As much as I'd love to pin the blame on George Osborne, I think we are talking about decades-long structural issues to do with the way government delivers services. And I don't think it is worth trying to point the finger at one individual person. However, I also don't think that means that we can just shrug our shoulders and move on and this all happens again in 6 months or 18 months' time. I really do think the government needs to learn proper lessons from this.
I mean, I think while I agree with the general principle that this is a long term, this is the latest fall down in a long term decline issue, I think it actually exemplifies part of the problem of these massive subcontracted contracts, that there isn't a one person that we can say, hey, you, the buck stops with you. And that's anti-democratic as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, that is a really big problem for the democratic oversight of public services.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think it's just such a huge area and there are so many people involved and so many, you know, decisions that have been taken at all kinds of different levels. I mean, you know, if we're going to pick one person, I don't know, maybe John Major, maybe Tony Blair, I don't know. They certainly would have had the power to at least begin to turn the tanker around and do something about it. But it falls to Theresa May, it falls to the current government to do something about it. They're ultimately responsible here. They might argue that it wasn't them personally that did this, that it was George Osborne or whatever. But, you know, it's happened on their watch. They need to do something about it.
And are they going to be able to? I mean, is there the flexibility of mind in government to change, to make that kind of major change to how they deal with public service contracts?
Probably not. And I don't think Theresa May is ideologically inclined to even do that. So it probably won't happen. But it is really only the government that can do it.
I'm not sure her backbenchers would allow her.
I mean, I'm not sure if she, I don't know if what you said is correct. I think she seems to be a very different, I think we forget that, we're in two different governments now compared to, we're not the Osborne, Cameron, Clegg government. And I think she's very, very different to David Cameron and George Osborne. And I think it wasn't the head of it, of Carillion. He was appointed under Cameron and Osborne as a CSR advisor. Christ. And apparently as soon as she got in, she got rid of him. So I think, I don't think many people really know who Theresa May is. She hasn't allowed anyone to see that yet. But I think she is different. I think she has got a good sense of fairness. And sometimes it comes back and bites her, because when she said that she wanted workers on company boards and she wanted to kind of interfere with the energy market, you know, everyone got up in arms across the whole political spectrum saying, oh, you know, you're not a socialist. What are you doing? She does have that element of fairness in her, and I think she does think about things in a different way to Cameron Osborne did.
I think that's probably right, that she thinks differently. I think she talks a good game. I really don't see much evidence that she walks the walk, though, when it comes to stuff like this. You know, yes, she's talked about workers on boards. Yes, she's talked about the fairness agenda and all of that stuff. I've not really seen much evidence that there's anything that she's done in government that's made that much of a difference. And I think the problem we now have is that she has a majority of like minus 15 or whatever it is. And she's not going to be in a position to be able to do any of the things she might even want to do. And that's even if she wants to do it in the first place. I think she is hidebound. I think most of the government's bandwidth is taken up with Brexit, and I just don't think that this will cause there to be much of a change in government policy, sadly.
I mean, I think that we're back where we always are when we're talking about making major change to Tory policy, and it's that Theresa May is stymied. No matter which way she goes, she's kind of stuck between her backbench, stuck between her own cautious instincts, stuck between... Yeah, I mean, we have, because we're doing this on the other week, we're not really discussing the reshuffle, but I mean, every one of her worst instincts was exposed again at that reshuffle. It was a terrible start to the new year for her. And it just feels like the narrative is set now. Mm. Now, having said that, this time a year ago, we thought the narrative was set for Jeremy Corbyn. And that has very much changed. And this brings me neatly on to our next topic for discussion, which is the Labour Party's NEC, National Executive Committee. So the Labour Party had some internal elections. Everyone get really excited. Woo-woo! And I believe there was a 20% turnout. Woo-woo! Yeah, really, really exciting stuff here, which, of course, has meant that the entire Labour Party is up at arms and at each other's throats. The left momentum slate swept the board, getting about double the closest of the next votes, which I think was Eddie Izzard, who got quite high on name recognition. Then their immediate response to this was to get rid of someone from their own slate who'd been running the disciplinary committee and replace him with somebody even more, not just to her left, but more willing to just do as they were told. Christine Shawcroft is a director of Momentum. She's not going to go against Momentum in any way, whereas Anne Black, who she replaced, was very much respected across the party as a fair dealer rather than a factional one. So before the push against Anne Black, I was quite sanguine about the whole Momentum have taken over the NEC business. I think a lot of people who were not Corbynites were running around like headless chickens, and the sky has fallen again. The sky has fallen again. The sky has fallen again. And I just feel like, you know what? If you want to change the Labour Party, if you want your side to win, instead of running around being all, woe is me, woe is me, actually go and talk to some of the people who vote in these elections. Maybe talk to some people, the 80% of people who didn't vote in these elections, see why they didn't, see whether they will next time. Maybe instead of just closing yourself off into smaller and smaller circles, actually reach out and try to attract people to your brand of politics. Otherwise, what are you doing and why are you doing it? I mean, it's... It would have been New Labour 101 to do all of those things 25 years ago. The fact that it's the New Labourites now who are utterly incapable of even understanding that's the first step that they should be taking in order to, you know, win more roles in their party is just ridiculous. And, you know, the Labour Party is really making a fool of itself. In terms of what's happened from the left and the disciplinary committees, I mean, we haven't seen any actual decisions go through that yet. So we'll see in terms of how she delivers and what actually happens. But I think Momentum have made a very, very foolish strategic error, in my opinion, by just going so hard so quickly rather than trying to act conciliatory at first and then boiling a frog, as it were, and changing us all around to their way of thinking by doing it slowly and doing it well. But that's my very insider baseball view. Mark, have you seen any of this? Do you have a take on this all the way down in Devon, or do you just think I'm just talking nonsense?
I don't think you're talking nonsense, but I don't think this is cut through to anyone who's not already pretty heavily interested in Labour internal party politics very much at all. I mean, I've followed it a little bit. I have to say that I think it's pretty short-sighted of the current Labour leadership to be putting place people in key positions like to do with disciplinary matters. The idea that if you have a problem and you end up in the disciplinary process, that you're going to be worried that decisions are going to be taken for factional reasons, even if they're not taken for factional reasons. The idea now that there's the perception that that might be the case, I think is very damaging to Labour. And I think it's very short-sighted of the Corbynites, Corbynistas, whatever you want to call them, to do that. I do think that it is a little bit hypocritical of the New Labour people to be complaining about this. I mean, this is exactly what Blair did. Blair put his people in place and tried to shape the party in his own image. He wasn't particularly successful at doing that for the long term, which is why we've ended up with Corbyn. I think if he'd been more successful at doing that, I think Corbyn would never have been elected because the structures would have been changed so fundamentally that that never would have been possible. And I also think from the New Labour people that the reason why they've been caught so flat-footed here is because I think they all thought that the arc of Labour history was bending in one direction and it was always going to be moving in the direction of kind of centrist third way triangulation politics. You know, the fact that David Miliband very nearly won the election, the leadership election in 2010, demonstrates, you know, actually just a few hundred votes had gone the other way. I think the Labour Party would be in a very, very different place from where it is now. And I think that they were complacent for many years. And I think Blair was complacent as well I think that he ran the party in a certain way. And I think he thought that after him, it would always be people who were kind of in his image, or at least from his wing of the party, who would continue to run the party. That hasn't happened. Having said that, I think the Corbynites have overreached themselves with the way that they've done this. And I think ultimately it will come back to bite them. I can't quite predict exactly how, because Jeremy Corbyn is all powerful within the Labour Party at the moment after the election last year and for the foreseeable future. But the seeds of politicians' destruction is often sown in the hubristic behaviour that they engage in when they think that they're at the height of their powers.
Chloe, I mean, you obviously, you're Conservative Party member and activist. You want to see the Labour Party doing badly, one assumes, although what's your take on this as from that perspective? And has this reached through to you at all? Did you see any of this on Twitter, or was it just the Labour Party bashing the Labour Party again?
No, I must admit, I didn't see any of the fine details, except that I just knew that three NEC members had been elected and they were all from Momentum. And that was about it.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of Corbyn as a whole, or the far left in the Labour Party as a whole, I mean, I don't really think this is necessarily going to go away. And I don't necessarily think they're going to do badly in an election. Because I think going on from what we were saying earlier about capitalism in general, or like style of running society or the style of politics, I think Corbyn's success is not necessarily about him being a socialist. I think it's about him being a conviction politician. And I think, I don't want to speak for everyone under the age of 30, but I think if the Tories had their Jeremy Corbyn, if they could find a really strong conviction politician as well, I think it wouldn't necessarily be an easy game for Jeremy Corbyn. I think this is not necessarily about socialism. I think it's about Corbyn understanding maybe the queries that the generation in this country have about capitalism, and tapping into it and saying this is our solution. We think we should nationalise everything and we think we should have a socialist state. And the Tories don't seem to have any solutions against that at the moment. They don't seem to be able to tap into coming up with proper policies to combat that, or coming up with solutions that my generation kind of want to hear. We're talking about things like rebelling, and obviously Corbyn rebelled for years and years and years against Blair. People like that because people think, well, at least he stands for something. And I don't think we've had that start. I liked Blair and Cameron, but we haven't really had a proper conviction politician really since Thatcher. Someone who you really knew what they stood for, and they were really determined to kind of change the country that they led. And I think it's just a generational thing. I think my generation really like having someone that they can really get behind, and they know what he stands for.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting. If you listen back to last week, Mark was saying that people like him and I have been too soaked in a way of doing politics for too long that we thought there were rules. And we don't understand the new politics as well as we understand those rules. And that's why we were so blindsided by the referendum, by Corbyn Corbyn doing quite well at the general election, because it didn't follow the rules that we thought existed. So you coming to this a lot more fresh than us just don't have that sense of this is how things have always been done, this is how things, you know, always will be done, that probably 15 years of being ground down by a system has given me, and 15 years of watching it from the outside has given Mark. Mark, would you agree that that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know whether I said it on this podcast or I was on the radio last week as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring back to.
I think, I mean, I might just be repeating myself now, but I think having 25 plus years experience of watching and having been involved in politics is a disadvantage now to understanding what's going to happen in the future, because I'm so hidebound by, like you say, the rules. And, you know, I honestly thought they would absolutely destroy Corbyn in the election. I thought, you know, they had pictures of him with Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and on platforms with people from Hamas. And I just thought that that would cut through and it would mean that Theresa May would get a majority of 100 plus, and it simply didn't happen. And I'm still slightly struggling to understand why, to be honest.
I don't think it's about socialism necessarily. I don't think it's about socialism. I think it's about the way he does politics. Mm-hmm. And I think people like that he's different. And I think they like that, you know, he's got strong beliefs. And so far, no other parties are coming, including my own, are coming back with anything to kind of combat that at the moment. I think this is about a new style of doing politics. I think this is my generation rejecting the Blair and the Cameron era of, you know, it's all about media management and slick presentation and being a charismatic leader in a certain definition of charisma. And this is about, we want politics again of real conviction.
Yeah, no, I think that's really fair. I think one of the places that is going to possibly trip up the left and the leadership in the Labour Party is the disconnect they have between where they are on Brexit and where the membership is on Brexit. And I think a lot of the vote last year was a soft Brexit vote. We want a softer Brexit. We think the best chance of that is voting Labour.
Yeah.
And I think that is going to be a cause for concern for Jeremy and the leadership. We're going to have to finish up in about 5 minutes, but there is one last story coming off the back of that that I think we ought to talk about, which is that we finally found the place that Tony Blair and Nigel Farage can get together and agree on, and that's on wanting a second referendum on the final deal, or a third referendum, or a first referendum, a referendum on the facts, as I think the Lib Dems are slightly bizarrely calling it. So... Chloe,
yes,
is a second referendum a good idea?
No, and not in my opinion. No,
why not?
And I was a passionate Remainer. I worked in a uni at the time, so I think that kind of added to it. I really don't feel comfortable with telling 52% of the population that they got it wrong, or that maybe they didn't know what they were voting for. I felt very uncomfortable in recent months about arguments that people didn't know the facts and they didn't know this, and they didn't know that. And if we are saying that this is just 52% of the population feeling disenfranchised and all the rest of it, telling them that they got it wrong isn't going to help, in my opinion. And I just think, you know, everyone's entitled to a voice, everyone's entitled to a vote, and that's how things happened. And I just really think we just got to get on with it now. And actually, I think if we had the right mindset, we could see it as an opportunity. You know, we're starting as a country, which is pretty scary, but you know, it could also be quite an exciting opportunity for us. But no, even though I was a Remainer, I don't feel comfortable with the idea of politicians telling people that they got things wrong. It really doesn't sit very well with me.
Mark, where do you stand?
I'm ambivalent on this. Part of me would like another referendum because I do think that Brexit is going to do a lot of damage to this country. And I think that that damage could be averted if we had another referendum, because I think there's a chance that the Remain side could win a second referendum for various reasons, which I probably won't go into now because we probably don't have time. I mean, yeah, just to go back to your point about the referendum on the facts, I didn't know that was the Lib Dem slogan, but referendum are never on the facts. I'll just put that on the record. And I think it's true to say, you were just alluding to this, Chloe, but people didn't know the facts because the facts were to a large extent unknowable. Nobody knew the facts. Nobody had any idea what real shape Brexit was going to take. So I therefore don't think it's unreasonable to say we're going to have a second referendum now that we know what the shape of the deal actually looks like, in order for the electorate to ratify that. The problem is that if the electorate was to vote no to that, well, they'd voted yes in principle to leave, but no in specifics to this way of leaving. I think that would just leave us probably in a worse constitutional mess than we are right now. So I don't know. The Remainer part of me would like us to have another referendum for a chance of averting what I think is going to be a disaster. But the part of me that doesn't want to see our constitution completely break down, and it's already pretty badly damaged by the fact that we now have a referendum result that very few people in Parliament actually wanted to see, and very few people in government actually wanted to see, I think we probably just need to plug on and leave the EU and hope that we can find some relationship with the EU that retains the best of what we currently have, and that is still seen broadly to implement what the people voted for.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, on the referendum of the facts as well, none of us actually know. Like, no one knows what this country is going to look in 5 or 10 years' time, or you know. So there are no facts because this is completely unknown to us, and it's, you know, we have no idea. You know, we can predict that it's going to cause a bit of a, you know, economic downturn for a little while. We can predict this, we can predict that, but the reality is, nobody knows. It's completely unknown to us. So there are no absolutes in this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in two minds, much like Mark. I I'm a staunch Remainer. I'm still a staunch Remainer. I haven't changed my mind on the fact that I think we'd be better off staying in. And when your side has lost the first go around, the opportunity for a second go around is an obvious go. Why wouldn't you go for it? You're not going to end up in a worse position than you are now. It's quite possible to win that referendum. I'm not sure it's possible to win with the people and the arguments we were making last time. I don't think that was done very well. I don't think it was done. It was done tin-eared. It was done in the same way as Mark and I were just saying. We had these 25-year sort of understanding of how politics works, which left us with tin ears as to how politics actually works. I think that was the case in spades for the people running the Remain campaign. But I also completely see Chloe's point about, you know, you can't just go around telling people they got it wrong. And that would, of course, whether or not that's what the Remain 2, whatever their message was, that is, of course, how it would be painted by Leave 2. So myself, I think there is probably a case for on the first day after Europe leaves the EU to start the new case, the case for a second referendum. You know, democracy is not a stopped clock. We don't have to make these cases once, you know, and that's it. In fact, we didn't, because we made the argument, we had the argument in 75 and we made a decision. And now we're having another, we've had another argument, and you could say we've made a decision. But that won't stop me from campaigning in the future to go back into the EU.
And nor should it. You know, Bill Cash and Theresa Gorman and John Redwood and Ian Duncan Smith didn't shut up about the EU for 20 or 30 years, but despite the result of the 75 referendum. So, you know, you crack on and I will too.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that may be the more democratic thing to do. Whether that's what I want in my heart, because what I want in my heart is to stop Brexit. But in my politically analytical mind, I think the more democratic thing to do is to do Brexit and then start the campaign again with better messaging.
See, in my heart, I actually feel now that it's quite an exciting opportunity. And
we shall see.
It's unknown, but to me, like, you know, we're getting literally a blank slate of paper as a country. And to me, that's quite exciting.
As someone who was a supporter of Ed Miliband, I would say don't ever use that phrase again. okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave it there on my fabulous Ed Miliband joke. Thank you so much for joining us, Chloe. It's been an absolute pleasure. And if we can bundle Nick off in a taxi anytime soon, we'll get you back, if that's okay.
Thanks, I've loved it. Thank you.
And
I really hope Nick is listening to this. That's the second time.
So do I. No, we love you and we miss you, Nick. But we've very much enjoyed your replacement, Chloe. So thank you, Chloe. And we'll see you next time, Nick. And thank you, Mark, as always.
Thank you.
And just before I go, can I please implore our listener, you lovely, lovely human being, to go out and, or in fact, stay in. All you have to do is sit by your computer and rate and review us on iTunes. It will help all the other lovely, lovely people find our podcast. So that would be great. First, and I'd like to just thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And just to remind you that this has been a Political Human production.